Welcome to the South Shore's Morning News Weekend Review Podcast. I'm Rob Hackelall. Listen for the next 30 minutes as we take a look back at some of the big interviews from the week on the South Shore's Morning News, which airs live weekdays from 5 to 10 a.m. Great to have you with us, and we are honored to have one of America's greatest political biographers on the line with us this morning. In fact, a number of awards for his last book, Richard Nixon, The Life, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2018. He has written a new book out on Ted Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, A Life. His name is John Farrell. He joins us now. John, good morning.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
Doing well. Great to have you on WATD. John, we talked about books you've written about Richard Nixon. Also Tip O'Neill. Tell us about how long in the plans did you want to work on a book on Ted Kennedy? I mean, we should mention, obviously, you worked for the Boston Globe. I imagine you had a chance to certainly know and talk about Ted Kennedy over the years.
I did. I worked for the Globe for about 20 years, and part of that was back in the 1990s. When Senator Kennedy went through, I guess, the second big crisis of his career with the Palm Beach rape case of his nephew, William Kennedy Smith, in which Teddy was famously described by one of the witnesses as wandering around the compound in Florida, somewhat dazed and without his pants on. And so that was great sport for Saturday Night Live, and really put him in a tough spot. And if you remember, the 1994 election was a very tough one in Massachusetts. He ran against a young Mitt Romney.
Yes.
And he showed the kind of perseverance that was characteristic, and came back and won that race.
Yeah. I saw a review in the LA Times. It says Ted Kennedy in a new biography is better and worse than you thought. What do you think about that?
That's kind of a fair rendering of the book. The thing I try to do with my books, especially considering that folks who actually watched Ted Kennedy and Richard Nixon in office are passing from the scene, is try to reach out to younger readers and say, you know, you only know this person as a caricature. You know, Richard Nixon had lots of grays in between the black and the white, and so did Ted Kennedy. And there was great triumphs in the Kennedy story, and of course there's great tragedies, and there's great mistakes as well, great flaws.
Yeah, I think that was one of the things I think you said in a recent interview, was that you'd like to have this book again for future generations that didn't live through the events, because you're right, it's easy, especially when you think about Richard Nixon, to boil it down to some, to Watergate and some of the, impersonations and masks. But there's a whole lot more, and that's kind of what you want to tell us about Ted Kennedy now, right?
Yeah, right now to a younger generation, and even to the medium generation that immediately followed mine, excuse me, Ted Kennedy is Mayor Quimby from The Simpsons. And there's so much more to this complex character. And if you're, you sort of know something about the Kennedys, hazy Marilyn Monroe, whatever, the assassinations, but it is still a gripping story. And Ted especially, I mean, he almost died and broke his back, couldn't walk for 6 months in a plane crash. He had three very close relatives killed in plane crashes. One of his sisters was the victim of a malpractice operation, brain surgery. His father had a stroke and was silenced. And that's even before you get to the two assassinations of Bob and Jack Kennedy. And so, I mean, it's just an unbelievable Shakespearean gothic tale that almost comes out with a happy ending, in that in the last 10 or 15 years of his life, Ted Kennedy really buckles down and does a lot of good things for a lot of people.
John, can you tell us about getting access to this new material? I was curious about how you were able to read segments of Kennedy's personal diary or these private conversations. Tell us about that.
Well, I knew that the diary was there because even as a reporter, you would see that before he would do a historical, or when I was doing my book on Tip O'Neill, I went in and interviewed him. And you could see that somebody had typed up a briefing book or a briefing piece of paper, going back through the through something and finding out what happened at the time to refresh his memory so that he was accurate in the interview with me. And it turns out that he talked into a tape recorder. The tapes were transcribed. They were sent up to the Kennedy Library and buried in the vault there for preservation. And whenever he had to do an oral history or be interviewed by somebody like me, he would have his staff pull that stuff out. He also had the staff use it when he was writing speeches. And the short answer is that the staff sometimes forgot to send it back to Massachusetts, or sometimes they made Xeroxes and they put it in files that would later become public. So that was part of my research, where I was looking for those files that had speechwriting files and others that had excerpts from the diary, and was actually able to find, some very amazing ones, one from the Vietnam War, from his meetings with Supreme Court justices, and another sort of big major turning points in his life. Nothing personal, all his personal thoughts about the political things that were going on around him. So I guarantee you that in 20 years, when those full range of diaries become public, it's going to be that will be a bestseller.
And Chappaquiddick, that will always be a big part of Ted Kennedy's legacy, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And there's a big part of the book that you discuss that and go in depth as well, right?
Yes, I had to be very, very careful because it's one, it's been gone over many, many times. Two, there's many, many theories and conspiracy theorists who believe that they know what happened at Chappaquiddick. I think I got the definitive version. I don't think that there's going to be ever much more added to the story than what's in my book, in part because I went and I looked through the diaries of Arthur Schlesinger, who was a speechwriter and an aide for John Kennedy in the White House, mm-hmm. and an advisor to both Robert Kennedy and Ted Kennedy. And in his diary, Arthur Schlesinger reports his conversations with Jean Kennedy Smith, her husband Stephen Smith, and with Ted Kennedy himself in the weeks after Chappaquiddick. And it is clear that although Ted never acknowledged this or admitted to it in public, that his initial reaction was to try to cover it up. And he told his aides to say nothing and do nothing, and swam the channel back to Edgerton and got dressed and appeared in the lobby of his hotel to establish an alibi. And that hope sort of vanished in the clear light of morning, and he finally was compelled to go to the police and report the accident. But that was a very real possibility for that, for those pre-dawn hours.
Ted Kennedy, A Life, John Farrell with us today, the book in store and online now. John, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks very much.
The Sound Shores Morning News continues. I'm Rob Hackelow with the morning team. Our special guest co-host today is Stacey Thompson. Stacey is the executive director of Livable Streets Alliance. She is with us right through the morning. Stacey, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, too.
Well, every week at this time, we check in with our tech guy, David Snell. He joins us on the line now from Act Smart IT in Wareham. David, good morning.
Good morning, Rob, and good morning, Stacey.
Good morning to you, too. Welcome.
All right, so the topic this week is about Facebook and how to give your Facebook privacy a quick checkup.
All right. We always talk about Facebook, and I'm pretty impressed with what we've been able to come up with here, because I've gone into Facebook a number of times and changed my settings, and to do that in the past, I would have to go through a list of settings that sometimes blind you as you're going through it, not really knowing what each one means. And as you probably know, Facebook's default privacy settings are pretty meager. So this is something that we all should be doing. So I went back into mine as we were getting this article ready for today and made some substantial changes that I hadn't made in the past. So I wanted to share this with everybody because there's a simpler way, a much simpler way now to adjust your privacy and also help prevent Facebook account cloning. And I'm sure you've seen that happen when you get friend requests from somebody you thought you had already been a friend with.
Yes, yes, that has happened to me, And I guess, unfortunately, I think this happened around the weekend when there were a lot of Facebook users that were compromised. A few people said briefly there was another Rob Hakala. And I felt very bad about that, as if I were responsible. But I said, well, what did I do? I don't know who that is. And then it went away, and Facebook sent me some message saying they were taking care of it. But that Rob Hakala went away. He had a beard.
Yeah, that was too bad. They like to have been two Rob Hacklers in the world.
I know. But yeah, I mean, but then I'm feeling bad about the whole thing, so I went and changed all my passwords again. But I probably should check these other settings. So tell us how to do it.
Yeah, these aren't really passwords. These are settings, privacy settings within Facebook itself. And if you, no matter how you use Facebook, whether you do it from a laptop or a desktop computer or a phone, we have the four steps you need to take to get into where the privacy checkup section of Facebook is. Mm-hmm. And there's a number of settings you can tweak to lock down your privacy. So what we're finding, and the most important thing, is to make most of your Facebook private, not public.
Okay,
so even if you're sharing photos of family and friends and all of that, if you make it private, your friends, the ones, people you have actually friended, will still see what you're doing, but the public in general will not. And there's where the problem is. The public in general usually includes some scammers trying to get access to your account.
Yeah. Okay, good point. All right, so friends and family, they're already in the bubble, so they're fine. So make it to private.
Exactly. So make everything private. Unless you really want to be found on Facebook by people that might be searching for you, there are ways to get around that. But if you just want to be found on Facebook with your friends and people that you have sent friend requests to and they've accepted, or people that have sent friend requests to you and you've accepted, those are the folks that you want to be, I think, more available to than the general public.
Yep. I hear you on this. I went in to update my privacy settings a few months ago, and I actually still found it kind of confusing. For folks who are getting on Facebook and maybe don't know how to click on their avatar, see all the little boxes you can check, what are the one or two things you think are most important for them to look out for and change in their settings?
If you follow the directions, the four steps that we have here, you click on the avatar, you go to settings and privacy, and privacy checkup, you're going to see five boxes that contain everything that you should be looking at. But the most important thing is to make your personal information private and not public. Now, your birthday is in there, your birth year is in Facebook. There's so many things in there that you don't want to be sharing with people.
Yeah. I mean, except your friends, because I want to get happy birthday messages.
Right, exactly.
And I always feel that people that shut that off, they want it too. I don't know why they shut it off.
They want to test you.
Yeah. See, I don't remember your birthday the old-fashioned way, right?
Yeah.
How's that, Rob? A calendar? A paper calendar?
Okay, yeah, I got to do that.
And would these, so for people who also have like an Instagram, because Instagram's owned by Facebook, should they be worried about their privacy on a different social media platform in the same way that Facebook sort of, the default setting is pretty loosey-goosey?
Exactly. That's the exact same thing. It's anything that you use that comes from Meta, the company. You want to make sure that you take care of the privacy and don't accept their default settings. Default settings across the board are always to the benefit of Facebook or Meta or Instagram, not to you, the user.
Yeah. Okay, so the steps here pretty much are what we should be doing. You're going to have those up on the blog, I imagine. So it's pretty easy, though?
It is. You can click into it in less than 20 seconds, and you're going to get five boxes that say who can see what you share, how to keep your account secure, which is important, how people can find you on Facebook, your data settings, and we all know about what Facebook does with our data, and then your ad preferences, which that's those ads that follow you around everywhere.
Yeah, yep, even when you talk or think about it.
I was thinking about it. Don't talk in front of Alexa, you're right.
Yeah, a new grill, and all of a sudden there's a grill. I don't know, it's crazy, but people say it all the time. It is weird, bizarre, but you know, that's how it works. So check out the privacy settings, and David's got, what, an easy five-step process?
Easy peasy for anybody who knows how to get into Facebook. They can find their picture on the upper right and go from there. It's very simple, and everyone should really do it. I was surprised when I went in and realized what I still had showing publicly.
Okay. All right. Yeah, it's probably worth it, because I bet most of us have been in there either never or in a long time.
Yep.
All right, good stuff. David, tell us where to people to go to get the steps for this.
Folks can go to xsmartit.com and click on my blog link and get the few steps to get you safe and sound on Facebook again.
xsmartit.com. David, thank you.
Have a great day.
Our Tech Talk segment on WATD, we do it every week at this time. Rob Hackala, great to have you along this morning. In this segment, we're going to talk about someone whose name many of us are familiar with, especially here in Massachusetts and specifically Marshfield. We're going to talk about Daniel Webster. This is where he spent his last days and is buried. And we're going to talk about a book called Indivisible. That's the name of the title, Daniel Webster and the Birth of American Nationalism. Joining us now is the author, Joel Richard Paul. He's also a professor of constitutional and international law at the University of California Hastings Law School in San Francisco. And he's the author of several other books, a lot of them about American history. Joel, good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here in Marshfield.
Yes, I was going to say, this is a book, as soon as it came up, I said, we got to get him on the show. We got to talk about Daniel Webster around here. Indivisible is the name of the book. So tell me about what led you to write the book, your interest in Daniel Webster.
Well, you know, a recent New York Times poll showed that more than 70% of the American people feel that our democracy is being threatened. People feel divided by the vexing problems of race and national identity. And it's a time when we really need to see more statesmanship from our political leaders and consensus. In the 19th century, Daniel Webster was that guy. He was the leading statesman of his time for 40 years as a Supreme Court advocate, as a member of Congress, as a Massachusetts senator, twice Secretary of State, and four times a presidential candidate. He was also the greatest orator of the English language. He really literally defined our American identity. And I think Daniel Webster offers us an example of what statesmen can do to bring our country back together and to build a consensus.
Yeah. I mean, you think about how bad it was now. Think how bad it was in Daniel Webster's time as a civil war is looming. And you're right. We talk about today, whether it be red states or blue states or certain groups, there's still talk about even now about, I mean, hopefully it never comes to this, but states breaking off. And you're right. There's about a national identity and that we're all Americans. And you talk about him being the defender of the Constitution. Tell us about that.
Well, he was the defender of the Constitution in the Supreme Court in many of the most important cases argued before the Supreme Court. But he was also the defender of the Constitution in the sense that he pushed back against the sort of racist, populist ideas that were promulgated by Andrew Jackson and the Jacksonian Democrats. He was the guy who basically said that it's the Constitution that defines us as Americans, and it defines all of us as Americans, regardless of our race or ethnicity or religion. Daniel Webster was the leading opponent of the War of 1812 and of the Mexican-American War. He opposed expansionism. He opposed slavery. He was really the conscience of New England. And in the process of talking about what it meant to be an American, he really redefined our ideas about our American identity.
Tell us about Daniel Webster in terms of course, we talked about him, you know, wanting to be president, and that would never happen. But he was certainly someone that others would turn to that would want him part of their team, right?
Absolutely, yes. He was, as I said, he was twice Secretary of State. He was the guy who was such a brilliant man. He could give speeches that would go for 4 to 6 hours, and the audiences would describe themselves afterward. People in the audience would describe themselves as being hypnotized by him. He was absolutely mesmerizing as a speaker, and he really changed the way we think about ourselves because his speeches became so popular that school children were required to memorize them and recite them in class for almost 100 years. That's how people learned rhetoric in America, was by reciting excerpts of Webster's speeches. And those speeches were all about the idea that we are all Americans.
Bring us back to those days before the Civil War and Daniel Webster and what, you know, he was thinking and talking about at that time as we were looming on the edge of coming apart as a country.
Well, you know, he made his reputation, as I said, as an opponent of slavery. He gave a famous speech at Plymouth where he denounced slavery, and he became kind of known as the conscience of New England. But he also recognized that the Union was the only vehicle through which slavery might ultimately end. His most famous speech, his most famous line was liberty and union, now and forever, one and inseparable. And he felt that the Union had to be preserved at all costs. And in 1850, when the country really was at the brink of going to war, Webster and Clay agreed to the Compromise of 1850, by which Webster endorsed the fugitive slave laws. This was incredibly distasteful for Webster and difficult for him, and it basically meant the end of his political reputation. But he sacrificed his own political ambitions in order to save the Union.
Yeah, I was thinking, because people were saying if he didn't, that the United States might have come apart prior to having Abraham Lincoln as president.
And in exactly, case, right.
Yeah.
Right. We would have had Millard Fillmore instead of Abraham Lincoln trying to hold the country back together. Think about that.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it also gave the Union 10 more years in which to build up its military and to unify itself. The anti-slavery movement became much stronger in the period from 1850 to 1860, and it helped to really create the generation of men who would fight and win the war to defeat slavery in the South.
Indivisible is the name of the book, Daniel Webster and the Birth of American Nationalism, and something that, you know, even though that was the past, here we are now, and hopefully we can stay together as a nation today, Joel.
I want to hope so. Daniel Webster, I think, is a great example of what statesmen can do.
Daniel Webster and the Birth of American Nationalism, Indivisible is the name of the book. Great book out from Joel Richard Paul. And we thought it would be great to talk about Daniel Webster. There's certainly a lot we can still learn from him today. That's for sure. So pick up the new book. It is out now in stores and online, Joel, right?
It's everywhere available to you. His time in Marshfield, he didn't just die in Marshfield. He lived in Marshfield. He loved Marshfield. Marshfield was really the place where he preferred to be rather than in Washington. It was hard to get him to go back to Washington because he enjoyed his time in Marshfield so much.
Mm. Well, we have definitely a fond place in our hearts for Daniel Webster around here, that's for sure. So congratulations on the new book, and we hope people enjoy it. Indivisible, Joel Richard Paul. Thank you, Joel.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it, Rob.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. As always, you can find us on your radio at 95.9 FM, mornings from 5 to 10, or online at 95.9WATD.com.
And you can catch up with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can get the links at 95.9WATD.com/SS Morning News. And join us next week for another edition of the South Shore's Morning News Week in Review.